Good morning. My name is Syed Ahmad. I'm from University of Cincinnati. I want to thank Drs. Kuby and Allen for moderating the session and the college for allowing me to give this talk on IPMN. My disclosure slide. So the incidence of IPMN has increased over the last several decades, mostly secondary to increased use of abdominal imaging, as has been already described in the last two talks. IPMN, or intraductal papillary mucins neoplasm, is usually classified under the category of pancreatic cystic neoplasms and account for about 20 to 30% of all cases. Morphologically, IPMN can be categorized into three types: main duct IPMN, side branch IPMN, and a mixture, which we call a mixed type IPMN, with the former having the highest risk of malignant degeneration. Now, estimating the true incidence of IPMN is difficult because majority of patients are asymptomatic. When they do present radiographically, as already has been described very nicely by the first two talks, they can present with cysts within the pancreas or dilated main pancreatic duct. And endoscopically, if they're diagnosed, the pathognomonic finding is what we describe as a fish mouth ampulla with extrusion of mucin. So how do we manage these cysts? So in 2006, the International Association of Pancreatology met in Sendai, Japan, to develop consensus guidelines, which have now become known as the Sendai guidelines. And these experts developed definitions of IPMN, as well as criteria for diagnosis, resection, and follow-up. And in this initial iteration of the consensus guidelines, they recommended resection for all main duct IPMN and side branch IPMN greater than 3 centimeters, those that were symptomatic, and those that were associated with mural nodules. It became clear, however, that that although the guidelines had a high negative predictive value, it had a low positive predictive value, which meant that a lot of patients were undergoing unnecessary surgery. So the experts met again in Fukuoka, Japan, to develop revised consensus guidelines, which became known as the revised Sendai guidelines or the Fukuoka guidelines. And in this iteration, the experts risk stratified patients with IPMN into having high risk, worrisome, or low risk features. Of note, in this second iteration, the authors no longer required surgery for all main duct IPMN and de-emphasize cyst size as an indication for surgery. The other high-risk features included having presenting with obstructive jaundice and having enhancing nodules within the cyst. In that same paper, though, the authors state that since the level of evidence for all items addressed in these guidelines are low, being 4 or 5, we still have to designate them consensus rather than evidence-based. So based on this, the Central Pancreas Consortium, which is a collaboration of 8 academic institutions, performed a study to evaluate these international guidelines to determine specifically each component of the high risk and worrisome category and their association with high-grade dysplasia and or invasive cancer, and to determine if the effects of having multiple factors present had on the overall risk of high-grade dysplasia and invasive cancer. In the study, we analyzed over 300 patients and found that the presence of obstructive jaundice, lymphadenopathy, and pancreatitis was associated with having high-grade dysplasia or invasive cancer. And of note, high-risk features including enhancing solid mass and main duct dilation over 10 millimeters did not reach statistical significance. Now, intuitively, this makes sense. These three features that we found to be significant are all clinical features, have binary outcomes, and are less subjective. Other features like enhancing solid mass or thickened wall are more subject and are dependent upon radiologic assessment as well as operator assessment of what they're looking at. So it's more subjective. In addition, we found the addition of any additional factors increase the risk of having high-grade dysplasia or invasive cancer, such that if a patient had one worrisome feature, their risk of having either high-grade dysplasia or invasive cancer is 30%, and that increased to 100% with 4 or more features. In addition, of any additional factor, increase the odds ratio by 1.39 of having high-grade dysplasia or invasive cancer. Now, we're not the only ones to report this. There have been previous data that supports this finding. This is a study from the Indiana group that evaluated 340 patients with IPMN. They categorized them as having low-risk, worrisome, or high-risk feature. And as expected, patients with high-risk features had higher risk of invasive cancer or hygodysplasia, and those with worrisome had a higher association compared to low-risk features. But the authors also looked at factors specifically. They categorized each feature as having clinical feature, which they caused, they categorized having acute pancreatitis or jaundice, and then the radiologic features. And when they looked at the radiologic features between categories, the increase in having hygodysplasia and invasive cancer went away, but was only seen in people with clinical features, suggesting that not all worrisome features are weighted equivalent. This is a study from University of Pennsylvania where the authors looked at cyst size and the relationship to hygodysplasia and invasive cancer, and again found that cysts greater than 3 centimeters had a 4 times more likelihood of having hygodysplasia or invasive cancer compared to cysts less than 3 centimeters. And in perhaps the largest study from a single institution, this is a study out of Mass General, where the authors looked at over 700 patients and evaluated 563, which are patients that had more than 1 year follow-up. Of these patients, 152 underwent surgery immediately and 411 were followed, of which an additional 88 underwent surgery. The authors then looked at the group with worrisome features and found that the risk of hygodysplasia and invasive cancer was over 30%. And when they looked at those with no worrisome features other than size and looked at the patients with cyst size greater than 3 centimeters, they found the risk of hygodysplasia and invasive cancer of 18%. So what does this mean? This means that the natural history of some of the worrisome features remain undefined, that there's conflicting data in the literature regarding the risk of malignancy for patients with worrisome features, and consideration should be made to consider some worrisome features high risk. In 2017, the authors of the Fukuoka guidelines revised their recommendations, and in this iteration, de-emphasized mural nodules so that only mural nodules greater than 5 millimeters were now considered high risk. Those less than 5 millimeters are now considered worrisome. In addition, the authors added serum CA19-9 and cyst growth of 5 millimeters over 2 years as worrisome features for patients with IPMN. So this is a current consensus algorithm that's recommended. You can see it's very busy, very complicated. And the problem with this algorithm is that it assumes that we can diagnose someone with IPMN with radiologic imaging like CT scans, MRI, and ultrasounds. And not every institution has Dr. Sekar working there that can make this diagnosis. And many institutions, diagnosing these with radiographic imaging is very difficult. In addition, these diagnostic imaging are not available to everyone. And if it is available, it's very operator dependent. If you look at the literature, diagnosing mirror nodules, cyst size, determining growth is very difficult for many radiologists, and even obtaining cytology for fluid analysis is difficult. So if a patient has worrisome features and there's no EOS available, then what should we do with that patient? So really what I want to emphasize is that Fukuoka guidelines are a useful starting point to guide physicians, but they are guidelines, and guidelines are not meant to be rigid. Clinicians need to know when to follow the algorithms, and they need to know when treatment recommendations have to be altered. There will be exceptions both ways. There will be Fukuoka negative patients that we should operate on, and there will be Fukuoka positive patients that we don't want to operate on and perhaps observe. Algorithms that help distinguish these in patients will be the most helpful in the future. So future guidelines will incorporate perhaps molecular analysis, which has kind of been touched on. This is a study from Brian Goh from Singapore. He did a meta-analysis of 600 patients looking at mucin subtypes and their ability to predict histologic subtypes of IPMN. We know there are 4 different histologic subtypes. We know that pancreatic biliary subtype is associated with most likely associated with invasive cancer. We know the gastric subtype is least likely to be associated with invasion. Intestinal subtype progresses to colic carcinoma. And in this meta-analysis, they found that the association of mucin 1 with the pancreatic biliary subtype, mucin 2 and 5 more likely to be associated with the indolent intestinal and gastric subtypes. The question really is, can we sample these mucin with ERCP, with EUS, and can we use this information to guide decision-making? This is a review paper by Dr. Maker, who's going to be giving the next talk. And in this review paper, he very nicely describes the use of cytology, KRAS mutations, GNAS mutations, as well as microRNA and their ability to predict invasion. So future decision-making algorithms may incorporate some of these more molecular subtypes. There are multiple institutions that have banked fluid analysis from CIS, and these studies are ongoing. But you know, I think the future of determining who to operate on, who not to operate on, will be based more than just morphologic characteristics, but also fluid analysis of DNA and microRNA. I want to shift gear a bit and talk about the extent of resection, recurrence, and survival. We know that the risk of recurrence after resection of an invasive IPMN is in the range of 30 to 40%. The risk of recurrence after resection of a non-invasive IPMN is a little bit more controversial. So in another study done by the CPC, we wanted to perform an analysis to answer four questions. What is the frequency of margin positivity after resection of non-invasive IPMN? What is the frequency of patterns of recurrence? Does margin positivity influence recurrence? And what is the timing of recurrence? So in this study, we analyzed over 330 patients, looked at patient demographics, disease characteristics, margin status, and recurrence data. Overall, the margin positivity rate from these eight academic institutions was 20%. Fortunately, most of these were low-grade dysplasia in Panin 1-2 patients. Only 2% of patients with positive margins had high-grade dysplasia or Panin 3, and the majority, 80%, had negative margins. When we looked at factors associated with positive surgical margins, the only factor associated with was multifocal disease. The degree of dysplasia, duct type, high-risk features, worrisome features did not predict positive margins. With regards to recurrence, our overall recurrence rate in patients undergoing resection of a non-invasive IPMN was 10%. Majority of these recurrences were IPMN recurrences, 6.7%. The minority were invasive cancers. Majority of these recurrences were associated with high-grade dysplasia. This was statistically significant. When we looked at duct type, again, there was a majority of recurrences associated with main duct IPMN, although this was not statistically significant. Where do these recurrences occur? In 65%, they occurred in the remnant pancreas. In 29%, they occurred at a distant site as metastatic disease. There's only two recurrences at the resection margin. One was associated with a positive high-grade dysplasia at the margin, and one had a negative margin but did have high-grade dysplasia in the initial index operation. With regards to what predicted recurrence, margin status did not predict recurrence. The only factor that predicted recurrence was high-grade dysplasia. Now, there's been a lot of controversy in the literature about how long we need to survey patients. In fact, the AGA has recommended surveying patients for only 5 years. And in this study, the majority of recurrences did occur in the first 2 years, but very interestingly, 18% of recurrences happened after 5 years, which emphasizes the fact that these patients need to be followed indefinitely. So to answer these questions, should we re-excise low-grade dysplasia and Panin 1 and 2 in the margin? Our recommendation would be no. Should we re-excise high-grade dysplasia and Panin 3 at the margin? We would say yes, based on the fact that we did have one high-grade dysplasia at the margin that did recur. And should post-op surveillance continue past 5 years, our answer to that would be yes. So in conclusion, the revised Fukuoka guidelines are a good starting point, but limitations and level of evidence need to be understood with respect to patient-level characteristics. IPMN represents a field effect, and monitoring of remnant gland after surgery is necessary. Surveillance needs to occur after 5 years, and additional molecular tools must be used in the future to determine risk of malignancy. Thank you.